Hi everyone, my name is Bryce Rankins and you're listening to episode 8 of Sneaky Geek. Hey guys, welcome back. Today, we're finishing our semi-educational discussion of comic book ages with our resident comic historian, Dave Ziegler. As you may remember from last week, the Golden Age started with Action Comics number 1 and the first appearance of Superman, and ended with Sensation Comics number 4 with the first appearance of the new Flash. The Silver Age goes beyond the mysticism of the Golden Age and incorporates science fiction into the mix and adjusts comics to a moral high ground through the CCA, or Comics Code Authority. But after some time, writers like Steve Ditko, Stan Lee, and Jack Kirby began exploring darker themes with more realism in their characters, from drugs to dire consequences for their actions, leading us into what's called the Bronze Age. The Bronze Age began early 70s and ushers in a new style of storytelling. So, let's find out what Dave has to say about that.
That is kind of how the Bronze Age starts, which is around the era that I'm the most familiar with as far as what I've read within it.
Right. What? Bronze Age is generally considered to be like 70s to 85 or so. DC's Crisis on Infinite Earths
The Age of Events.
Is pretty much the end of the Bronze Age because DC takes this multiverse that they've got and condenses it down to a single universe as part of their 50th anniversary.
Right.
Which I always thought was an odd choice because, you know, one of their stated reasons for doing that was to kind of clean up the universe, you know, make it less confusing to new readers. But I started reading DC as a kid, first, second, third grade. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not first. I was looking at the pictures by then. I never had any trouble with the concept of alternate Earths.
Yeah. I know that one of the reasons why Crisis on Infinite Earths was created was because Superman was no longer the last son of Krypton. There was like 5 other super people from Krypton at that point. And it was getting to the point where it was like, buddy, you're not lonely. It's why what happens to Supergirl within that, storyline ends up, you know, happening. Because it's like, now they just got to go.
Yeah, because you had Supergirl, you had Krypto, the super dog, yep. Streaky, the super cat, Beppo, the super monkey. But you also had all the dudes from who had been in the Phantom Zone who would escape on occasion.
Yep.
You had the entire bottled city of Kandor, shrunken down by Brainiac. So I don't remember who made the comment, but one of DC's creators made the observation that it seemed like the only people who actually died in Krypton were Superman's parents.
Yeah, and I know that in the opening note, the little preface before you read Crisis on Infinite Earths, they talk about how, you know, the idea of cramming all these characters together to create this massive event, which is what it ends up being, was so huge that, like, they had to work on it for, like, 4 years to get everything taken care of.
Yeah.
They'd announced it, I think, 4 years, like, alluded to it at a convention of some sort or a press conference or whatever, 4 years before they even start producing the story.
Well, sure. Well, the buildup was intended for DC's 50th anniversary.
Right.
And I don't think it was 4 years, but it was at least 2.
Yeah.
Because that's when we start seeing the first appearances of the Monitor. The one of the protagonists in Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Right, right. Well, the buildup within the universe starts then, but apparently the idea of just getting this whole story together and how they were going to finagle all of their comics kind of becoming one for a moment, you know, that massive editorial
a fair
difficulty.
Point. Yes. So,
yeah.
But before we get to that, we've got this sort of rising tide of comics in terms of maturity, storyline, content, things like that, while they're paradoxically becoming less available. Because we're starting to transition from newsstands, drugstores, to direct sales comic shops.
Right.
You know, the rise of the comic shop, the rise of the direct market.
And the rise of the comic shop and the direct market, which we discuss in another podcast, does that happen during the Bronze Age? Late 70s?
Yes.
Okay.
So late 70s, early 80s.
I want to say record shops as well start holding comic books. Is that right? Am I seeing that? Because I know that's a trend now.
It's a trend now? Really? I mean, record stores and comic shops?
Certain record stores. Like, a lot of the more indie music stores, I feel like, have, like, a little comic book section.
Hmm.
I know Amoeba sure as heck does.
But really?
Amoeba's kind of a beast of their own. But, yeah, Amoeba's got a whole comic book section.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Next time you take a trip to the Arclight, because it's a great movie theater.
That is true. So we're talking about L.A. Amoeba.
As far as I know, that's the only one I know of. Yes, I have purchased comic books from Amoeba.
Interesting. You're not aware of the other Amoeba records?
I don't know of the other Amoeba records comic store.
Okay. You're aware that there's another Amoeba record.
It's in the Bay Area, is it not?
Yes.
Yes.
That's where it started.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
So anyway, ignoring my record store question, we have the idea of actual comic stores.
Yes.
Where they're not just selling, you know, action comics and this lovely serial of an anthology, but we're selling the issues and your pulls.
Well, keep in mind that by this point, Action Comics is Superman.
Yeah, and it's single issue.
Single character, single story usually, but sometimes with like an 8-page backup.
I like the 8.
Yeah, the 8. DC.
They still do those to this day.
Not as often.
No, but.
But DC was big on the 8-page backups, and I loved those because you'd get things like, in DC Comics Presents, which was the Superman team-up book, you'd also get Whatever Happened To... ... And it was, you know, kind of Whatever Happened To Our Man from the Golden Age. Whatever Happened To Rex the Wonder Dog, who was an adventure character who was a dog.
Kind of like really shortened versions of the What If issues, but with...
But these were intended to be more like in continuity or in canon.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
See, because every instance I've ever seen of the additional, you know, 8-page backouts has always been either a preview of an existing book or a short lead up to a book. So it's sort of like
we decided
to put the prelude in 10 issues of Avengers. So if you get all 10 issues of Avengers while their story is like 3 different arcs, you'll get the little bit at a time leading up to the big event.
Well, this was not what those were. These were legit self-contained stories in their own right.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes you'd have like a continuing feature, like in Brave and the Bold, which by this point had gone from being a tryout book to becoming a Batman team-up book.
Okay.
You had Nemesis. It was the ongoing backup feature that had an end game. There was an end point in mind.
Yeah.
So, you know, Action Comics, you'd have alternating backups with the Atom and another teen hero called Airwave.
And this starts in...
This is all Bronze Age stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So this is when they start experimenting with their medium then.
Yeah.
A lot more. And not just experimenting with the medium story-wise, but like with their actual...
With format.
Format.
Yeah, because you also... DC also did the dollar comics in the 70s.
Okay.
Thicker books, a dollar, frequently anthologies.
Which in the 70s was more than the cost of a standard book.
Double the cost of a standard book.
Yeah.
And there was some really cool stuff. You know, Detective Comics was an anthology featuring the Batman family. You had Superman family, which would have backup characters. You'd have Mr. and Mrs. Superman, the Earth 2 Superman and Lois Lane, who were married. You'd have Nightwing and Flamebird. Not Teen Titans Robin Nightwing, but Nightwing and Flamebird, the heroes of the Bottled City of Kandor. A Jimmy Olsen solo adventure, a Supergirl solo adventure, a Lois Lane solo adventure. So
cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
World's Finest was another anthology.
So they're experimenting with throwing, basically kind of like the annual, but you can throw it out whenever you want to.
Well, they were monthly books.
Oh,
These were monthly books.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the horror anthologies went monthly for a while. GI Combat was a dollar.
I guess the modern equivalent is probably more like the Marvel one-shot, where they'll put together a kind of a more, like a, you know, a single self-contained storyline.
I would not say that that's necessarily the same kind of thing.
Perhaps not the equivalent, but...
But
I'm just trying to see how much of this affects modern comics, I guess, is where I'm kind of trying to draw the line, because I feel like everything else, its effect on modern comics is so broad-reaching and you can see it all. But I guess maybe Bronze stuff hasn't fully shown itself as...
Well, I feel I feel like modern comics have kind of calcified, because the superhero stuff is the same old stuff. There's not a lot of experimentation, and worse, you get this expansion into lines. I'll give you an example. One of Marvel's biggest sellers in 15 or 16 was the Black Panther relaunch. Okay, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is an outstanding writer, making his comics debut, and it's sold crazy numbers. And so Marvel says, oh, well, if people will buy one Black Panther, let's make it a line. So they expanded it to two other books.
Like what they did with Spider-Man.
Like what they did with Spider-Man, like what they did with Wolverine, The Punisher, you know, and people just weren't having it. It's like, look, if I'm going to buy a Black Panther comic, I'm going to buy a Black Panther comic.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in the Black Panther and the crew. I'm not interested in Worlds of Wakanda. Even though Marvel was doing some cool stuff by bringing in writers of color and people who don't normally have a seat at the table, right, from a creative standpoint, instead of looking at everything as a cash cow, as a revenue stream, and DC does some similar things. And part of that is because both Marvel and DC have corporate masters they have to satisfy.
And it's one thing to say they're self-contained and this just happens and the other characters just didn't know about it.
Right.
It's another thing to say they were there, but they were also over here doing this.
And it's the Wolverine problem. If he's in Uncanny X-Men and New X-Men and Wolverine.
That's why they killed him off.
X-23 or whatever.
Anyway, coming back to it.
We get into the 80s and we're seeing experimentation. There's some experimentation with like a mature readers line. Marvel is trying out Epic Illustrated, which is like a magazine size. And Marvel had done some magazines earlier. You know, there was a Hulk magazine. There was a Marvel Premiere, Marvel Preview. One of those two. It had the same title as one of their comic series. There was The Deadly Hands of Kung Fu. You know, trying to cash in on the Kung Fu craze of the 70s.
That's fair.
Yeah. So Epic Illustrated, an anthology magazine, trying new stuff. They tried their hand at an event with the Secret Wars.
Ah, yes.
The first Secret Wars, still the best.
And that's the one with Black Suit Spider-Man. And
that's where Spider-Man gets the black suit, where She-Hulk becomes part of the Fantastic Four while the Thing is on a leave of absence. Chris Claremont is doing some outstanding work on the X-Men.
Someone once described to me the reason that Secret War, at least as far as the stranger in the comic book shop had felt, the reason the Secret War to them was so successful was because it was at a time when all of the writers and editors really knew what each other were doing. And that you could tell in the comics that there wasn't this giant convolution of grabbing for every opportunity they could to put every character in there, so that when it came time to organize an event, it wasn't, well, guess what, you're on this now. It was, okay, here's the entire thing, here's how it's going to play out, and it felt like they were working together better.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily the case.
I mean, I think part of it was a stranger in a comic shop.
Right. Well, part of the thing is that Marvel was publishing a lot fewer comics then.
Yeah.
You know, there was one Captain America book, one Iron Man book. Were there two of... Had they started the West Coast Avengers yet?
If they were, they were on the West Coast.
There were only one or two Avengers books.
Right.
One X-Men book. What?
One X-Men book. We killed off every mutant except for 140, and we still couldn't have just one X-Men book.
Right.
Spoilers, 2005.
But one of the things that Secret Wars does do, we get to the end of issue X of X-Men, or issue X of Captain America, or issue X of Spider-Man. The Secret Wars transporter is there in Central Park. It whisks them away, and there's a little asterisk at the bottom of the page. See Secret Wars number one.
Yeah.
We go off to Secret Wars, but the next month, issue Y of X-Men of Captain America, everybody poof shows back up to see, and with a little asterisk at the bottom of the page, to see what happened. Check out Secret Wars 1-12.
Wow.
Okay. Now, yes, there had to be some choreography between, for example, I think it was Tom DeFalco that was writing Spider-Man at the time.
So they came back before Secret Wars was done?
Yeah.
Okay.
But
which is a regular problem in events.
Well, but Shooter and Mike Zeck had Secret Wars plotted out.
Was it a monthly?
Yeah, it was a monthly.
So you had to wait a year to figure out why Spider-Man came back with a black suit.
Only 8 months.
Without spoiling it.
Only 8 months.
Okay.
But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that's one of the tough things that has happened before, where a panel of a comic book, this happened a few years ago in an event,
mm-hmm.
where a panel of a comic book came out and it was very clear that somebody wasn't going to make it in the big event
mm-hmm.
that hadn't come out, and it wasn't going to come out for another 6 months. Like, well, I guess we know how that one ends.
In part because comics weren't late then. They stayed on schedule no matter what.
I'm looking at you, Brian Michael Bendis.
It's not just Bendis.
I know, but he is notorious.
And part of that was because editors had inventory issues. Because a lot of comics were what they called done in one. You know, they were either standalone issues, two-parters, things like that. They weren't writing these six-issue mega arcs.
Right. With, you know, minor crossovers and characters coming in and coming
right,
out.
Right. With the idea of everything being collected. Hell, back in those days, almost nothing was collected.
Yeah. Yeah, I look back to some of my older comics, and it's about every 12 to 14 issues of one particular comic or another that they'll bring in one side character. I happen to collect 90s era New Warriors. And
that's some good stuff, yeah, those first 2-3 years or so.
Yeah, it's really good. And, you know, Spider-Man shows up at one, or some other character, or some other villain when that happens. Those are the issues that are a pain in the ass to find. Because,
mm-hmm.
oh, this is a nice, you know, this is a crossover issue. But they're a pain in the ass to find because they weren't happening constantly. But again, that's the 90s. That's after the alleged Bronze Age, which kind of closes out this whole discussion. I mean, really,
yeah.
What else happens in the Bronze Age of note? Bronze Age ends with major events when what happens in the world of comics, not necessarily in their stories, but in the industry, that leads us into this modern, I don't know, Iron Age?
Not iron. There's a lot of argument about what to call it. Is it the Copper Age? Is it the Dark Age?
Personally, I think it should end right around the middle of the first 10 years of the 2000s. If I were to end the era...
The Bronze Age?
No.
Whatever the next age was.
Yeah, because that's around the time you get Identity Crisis, and that's around the time you get Disassembled. When we go... Our teams don't actually work together that well, and we start to look at the psychiatric problems of being a hero in a more... I mean, we look at what happened in Identity Crisis, and we look at what happened in... Around the time where we really start to explore the dynamic of how these people work together, you can't just stay a team on altruism alone.
Well, yeah, I suppose.
There's also a massive change in art right around 2000, so that's what spiky hair and pouches are.
Well,
rampant.
Once we get into the earlier mid-90s, we start getting into the rise of Image, you know, Image Comics.
Right, and then there's the massive bankruptcy.
Marvel's bankruptcy. Yeah, but if we're talking strictly in terms of, like, comic events, I have no idea what to call the post-Bronze Age.
Yeah.
I kind of like the Copper Age, but the Dark Age seems kind of appropriate, too. I think part of the problem is that...
But Starlin's Infinity stuff is wonderful.
Most of it. Infinity Gauntlet is brilliant. Did we need two sequels?
All right.
You know? I mean... This is a podcast, and because you're listening to it at home, you can't see Dave shrug his shoulders during his prolonged silence.
Or Bryce staring... thousands of yards away, just not really sure what to say about that many sequels. I don't know. I feel like there's a definite turn in comics around the mid-2000s, but there's also a definite turn in comics in art and in writing around the mid-90s. You know,
it feels
like there's two ages that happened between then and 2005, you know?
Sure. In the 90s, you know, particularly the mid- to late 90s, one of the things that DC does post-Crisis on Infinite Earths is because everybody's now on one Earth, we start getting this idea of legacy. Barry Allen dies during the Crisis on Infinite Earths.
No.
Wally West steps in as Flash. The former Kid Flash now assumes the role of his mentor.
Right.
It's the first step down this path of legacy.
Got it.
The Justice League carries on the legacy of the Justice Society. You know, with the death of Superman, you've got Superboy, who hangs around after Superman comes back. But Hal Jordan becomes a bad guy. Oh, you don't know that story?
Oh, is this Black is or Dark?
Emerald Twilight.
Emerald Twilight, okay.
Yeah. So we've got a new Green Lantern in Kyle Rayner. He's the last Green Lantern. Oliver Queen, Green Arrow, dies. But we find out he's got a son who's been hanging out in a monastery. Monastery, thank you. I almost said like a nunnery, but for monks. But a monastery. And he becomes the new Green Arrow. Jack Knight becomes the new Starman, inheriting the role from both his father and his older brother. So you've got this. So legacy is definitely a thing for DC throughout this time period. Meanwhile, at Marvel, 90s were a hard time for Marvel for a variety of reasons. The image artists leaving, bankruptcy, some of the art stuff was just, some of their books were just bad.
But on the same token, we have the 90s Spider-Man cartoon.
Yeah.
We have the X-Men cartoon in the early 90s.
Sure.
And
but Marvel's not producing those.
No, but Marvel properties are growing in the public eye.
Okay, that's fair.
But at the same time, so are DC's. I mean, we have been running the Super Friends early mornings for I don't know how many decades at this point.
Sure. But then we get Batman the Animated Series.
Superman the Animated Series.
Yes.
Which I actually, now that looking back, I watched as much, if not sometimes more, than the Batman Animated Series.
Oh yeah, they were both really great.
Oh yeah.
The Batman Animated Series gets all the dap because it was first. And because those Bruce Timm designs are so
iconic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we've got all those properties growing. And then we've got just the public acceptance of superheroes, I think, is starting to become a little bit more kind.
Sure. And that becomes a double-edged sword for Marvel and DC because they've become strictly superhero publishers.
Yeah.
Feeding the canon, feeding the continuity. Mm-hmm. And originally, way back in the Golden Age, you had adventure heroes, you had funny animals, you had teen humor, westerns, science fiction, all genres that Marvel and DC just aren't publishing. You know who's publishing all kinds of genres these days?
Image.
Image is publishing a lot, although they tend to be trending more towards science fiction.
Yeah.
But you've got Archie doing all kinds of different stuff.
Oh, yeah.
With those Archie characters. Both the traditional teen humor and teen drama.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Boom Studios.
I love Boom Studios.
They publish the Steven Universe book.
They do.
They publish, you know.
Lumberjanes,
WWE comics, Power Rangers comics, mm-hmm. IDW. They do a lot of licensed books, but they've got some original stuff going too.
And a lot of these other guys are doing books by artists that are regularly with Marvel and with DC.
Yeah.
I mean, Bendis has his own run. Wade has his own run. G. Willow Wilson had her own comic within those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And they are they're like an outlet, it would seem, for non-superhero stories. But last year we were reading that article about 10 comics that you can read that are about superheroes that don't deal with superhero problems.
Right.
And it's everything from the Hawkeye storyline when mm-hmm. he's kind of going about his day-to-day and dealing with that kind of stuff with a mm-hmm. little bit of espionage. Doctor Strange dealing with the fact that he doesn't have powers. Well, it's still centered around his powers. You know, that's not as mm-hmm. big world-ending monster and I'm going to find my way out of
it. I'm going to wave my magic hands. Now magic comes with a price.
Yeah.
And we see how he has to navigate that. Yeah. But we also get...
But that's, you know, 15 years, 20 years after that.
But we also have these creators who do a lot of superhero work working outside of Marvel and DC because Marvel and DC doesn't do creator ownership anymore.
Mm.
You know, Vertigo, one of the reasons that Vertigo was big for a while was because the creators owned their work. They were willing to give their best stuff.
Because
they got to keep it, and because they got money from the media rights and things like that.
Yeah.
Once Warner Brothers buys DC and starts really kind of looking at DC, like remembering that they have a comics publisher that they can farm for IP, for intellectual property, they redo the contracts so that, well, now the creators don't get as much money,
yeah.
if they get any at all. And so why would you give your best stuff to Joe Corporate when you're not going to see anything for it.
Yeah. And that all comes out of this kind of modern era as a sort of response to what happened in the 90s.
Well, not just in the 90s. I mean, comic creators for decades have largely been considered workers for hire. Jack Kirby didn't have ownership of any of the characters he created for Marvel, and there were a ton, because he was considered work for hire.
Yeah.
Now, there was a big lawsuit by the Kirby estate against Marvel and Disney trying to reclaim those copyrights, because thanks to a clause in the most recent copyright law, there was a window during which creators of a property could sue to reclaim ownership of that property from the corporations.
Yeah.
And it took a long time, but eventually Marvel and Disney settled, let's just say it's a big number with the Kirby estate, commensurate with his contributions to not just the publisher, but to the field as a whole.
And when that happened, I remember it being almost like the payment wasn't so much a, please let us keep this, we're buying this from you, as much as it was, you should have made this money all along, considering how much money's been made. It's kind of like that Batman and Me documentary that just came out. I know that had
the Bill Finger one, documentary. Yeah. I guess that's one way to look at it.
That's kind of how it felt, at least to me.
I don't know if Kirby estate felt that way. But if Disney and Marvel really felt that way, why aren't they doing those kinds of deals for their creators now?
No.
Yeah. You don't see...
They're doing it that way because they needed them to stop.
Bingo. You don't see...
This is no altruistic, righteous move on the mouse's part.
You don't see creators generating a lot of new characters for a couple of reasons. A, why would I give you my new toys when...
There's plenty of toys to play with already.
When I may not get to keep my new toys, when you can take my new toys and not let me play with them ever again whenever you want.
Right.
There are already a bunch of great toys in the toy box, and there's just no, what's the benefit to me?
Yeah. Well, and in the last several years, I can think of two toys that have shown up in the Marvel world. One is the Sentry, and the other is Kamala Khan. And she is an existing property, but her story is far more interesting to me than Carol Danvers' Ms. Marvel.
Right.
Ms. Marvel, as Carol Danvers' Ms. Marvel becomes interesting when she's interacting with other people, in my opinion. I mean, her stuff with Rogue is fascinating. Her stuff with Spider-Man is fascinating.
I didn't know she had stuff with Spider-Man.
She has a small romance. They have like one date. It's awful. But I have the issue. I'll let you borrow it. But it starts with a lot of flirting in their time when they're both on the Avengers. And it builds itself up. And eventually they're like, you know what? We should go on a date because, you know, you're single. We don't really know why. I'm single. We know why. And they go on a date and they're like, we have nothing in common when we're not fighting crime. This isn't going to work.
You know, is that Bendis?
It might be. Brian would know.
You know, I will say this. I really love the way, not so much lately, but originally, how he was writing the relationship between Jessica Jones and Luke Cage.
Agreed.
In the New Avengers, those early issues.
His run on that was fantastic. And them dealing with having a kid and how they both felt that the child should live in the world
in the superhero world.
Live in both, really. Yeah. But she has to pretty much exist only in the superhero world for a while. I mean, they're living in the mansion.
Right.
And they have to, like, they have a whole episode where they're trying to figure out who's going to be their nanny.
Mm-hmm. And that was such a riot.
It was hilarious. And then they settle on this sweet, kind, forgotten character.
Kind of goofy
girl named Squirrel Girl. And she's smart and witty. And then 2 years later, Marvel turns her into a joke. I really don't like modern Squirrel Girl. She upsets me because I feel like she's nothing compared to what she used to be.
Yeah, that's fair.
And you know, it's kind of a bummer for me. But I've heard that her books are really, really great. But she's also the unbeatable Squirrel Girl. And while I know every superhero is going to win by the end of the storyline, I think that's part of the joke, though. It's to the point of parody in her character. I feel like while I like her in parody, I also like Deadpool in parody, but Deadpool still gets to exist in the X-Force.
Fair.
And when he's in the X-Force, he's not selling chimichangas. He's cutting off portions of his skin and feeding him to a dying archangel in order to keep him alive, going, please don't die, please don't die, please don't die. You know,
ew.
He's being a good guy.
He's being a bro.
Yeah. And I don't see they don't seem to give Squirrel Girl that opportunity for heart anymore. Okay, so can we talk real quick about toys before we get out of here?
Yeah, sure. What do you want to know?
Well, You know, there's
this literal toys or the metaphor that I was just using about characters.
I'd like to talk about literal toys.
Okay.
You know, the running consensus, I feel like, especially regarding the introduction of events, is that it was largely toy driven.
Yes. Secret Wars was in a lot of ways about selling action figures.
So, I mean, action figures, especially of comic book heroes, have been around for long before the smaller sized ones that show up in the early 90s. You know, the G.I. Joe sized Captain Americas and things like that exist.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like they pushed comic book sales as much as were just part of one. Am I wrong on that?
No, they did not push comic book sales. They were an adjunct. I mean, because by the time the figures hit the stands, Marvel, as the license holder, had made their money.
Yeah.
They licensed it out to Kenner, I think it was, initially.
Yeah.
And then they get their money for the licensing fee.
Blue rectangle, white cursive letters.
Yeah.
Kenner, yep.
And, well, sometimes blue cursive letters. But anyway. and then Kenner has to sell the figures.
Yeah.
But then Marvel gets into the toy making business because they buy Toy Biz.
Ah.
Which is just one step along the line of shitty mistakes or shitty decisions that Marvel makes, which culminates in their bankruptcy.
And this happens around the time of Secret Wars?
Oh, no. The bankruptcy was in the 90s.
Well, bankruptcy's in the 90s, but I mean the Toy Biz purchase.
Also in the 90s.
Also in the 90s. Roughly mm-hmm. around the time of X-Men, I would wager.
X-Men.
The television series. I had a lot of X-Men action figures. I feel like they all have Toy Biz written on their feet.
Well, but they probably do have Toy Biz written on their feet, but Marvel did not own Toy Biz initially.
Ah, okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Avi Arad, I think that's how you say his last name, came to Marvel through Toy Biz. And he was kind of an early architect of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Well, maybe that's probably overstating things. But he was working on X-Men. You know, he was part of that project, the X-Men film. Mm-hmm. And then Blade was part of his.
So the idea of making films about superheroes at all, does he have anything to do with the 1994 Fantastic Four film?
Is that the Roger Corman one?
I think so. It's terrible.
It is terrible. It's
a great riff
well,
tracks.
Let me rephrase.
Looking for a good riff tracks.
It is both terrible and yet better than anything that Fox has done, rather, with Fantastic Four.
You didn't like the original of the two sequels? Or the two sequels of the two films with that British fellow, Jessica Alba, and the guy from The Shield as Ben Grimm and Chris Evans as Human Torch?
No.
Not at all? Not even remotely? Barring any issues with the directorial choices toward Sue?
I'm not sure what you mean by directorial choices.
Well, I guess that's giving a lot of credit to and a lot of stock to the stories that Jessica Alba tells. But Jessica Alba, the way she describes her time as Sue Storm, was with a lot of disagreements with the director and producers as to how Sue Storm should be portrayed and whether she should be as intelligent as she should be. Granted, the it's the director or the producer's fault happens to come up a lot in Jessica Alba's career and her interviews after bad films. She tends to throw directors and producers under the bus a lot after making bad movies, of which there are plenty. I mean, I may be wrong on this, but from her standpoint, she was not allowed to be the Sue Storm that much of us have come to love. But aside from her, do you still have a lot of problem with the initial film?
Yeah, I just didn't think they were very good.
Okay.
You know, I mean, and particularly when you get into the sequel and Galactus is a fucking cloud.
Yeah.
Even if they had just given us a giant ass hand coming out of the cloud, could have saved that sequence, but.
So toy line is the driving force. They eventually buy Toy Biz.
Yeah.
And that's how that goes. And that's a whole different podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it. There's not really a lot that drives. I feel like using toys as a marketing tool and starting these big events operate in tandem.
They do now, because we see like Marvel doing lines for Hulk Thor Ragnarok,
right.
Guardians of the Galaxy 2, the different variations of the Avengers line, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. Am I misunderstanding your question?
Well, I'm trying to help
the event
to define the age, the first age that takes place after the Bronze Age, although not by name,
you
but just
could,
like what well, characterizes
events,
the late 80s.
Events are become a thing. DC, you've got in no particular order, because I'm an old man now and I can't remember which came which. Mm-hmm. But you've got Armageddon 2001. You've got Millennium. You've got Zero Hour, War of the Gods.
Isn't there a second Crisis on Infinite Earths eventually, too?
Infinite Crisis, Final Crisis. But those come...
Those are much later.
Those are in the 2000s.
Yes.
But, and over at Marvel, you've got Fall of the Mutants. You've got X-Men Inferno, which crosses over through several non-X books. Mm-hmm. You've got the Infinity Gauntlet. You've got these annual events where groups of annuals are crossing over. You've got Atlantis Attacks. That was one of the first ones that Marvel did after Secret Wars. So you've got these big crossover events where maybe you have to buy the crossovers, maybe you don't. They always say, well, you don't need to buy the crossovers to get it. But frequently you do. I mean, yeah. The Secret Empire monstrosity that Marvel just finished with Nazi Captain America.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to buy the crossovers. Well, but there's some key facts, I guess, that come out in the crossovers.
Yeah.
Setting aside the fact, the completely appalling fact that you've got Captain America, created by a couple of nice Jewish lads, as a Nazi.
It's not the first time he's been a Nazi.
Isn't it?
I feel like there was another Nazi Captain America where he wasn't like a full Nazi, but like it was the same situation. Something was wrong with Captain America. In this case, something's wrong with Captain America's timeline.
Well, in this case, something's wrong with Marvel Comics for thinking this was a good idea.
Certainly.
You know, I'll concede that maybe when they planned it, they didn't think that... You know,
their first issue was going to become a meme because people were so upset about Captain America being a Nazi.
There were sufficient warnings that this was a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much...
We've kind of run off the rails here.
No, and I've been monitoring since that point because I was like, this is the point where we're in... Okay. Everything after Bronze Age, we're pretty much in...
off the rails. Okay.
So that's the Bronze Age.
Right.
So we have Golden Age. We're starting in 1938.
Right.
Action Comics number one.
Uh-huh.
Superman on the cover lifting a car.
Yep.
We get to the end of the Golden Age, and we
kind of vague, but it's...
Most ages are.
Yes, but the Silver Age very clearly starts in 1956.
Six. October 1956 with Showcase number four.
Yes.
Right.
And that's very... Barry Allen, the Flash.
Barry Allen is the Flash. And yep. Everyone says, hey, superheroes are a thing again. Let's get those guys. Let's throw them in some science.
That's right. And so that's the start of the Silver Age. And there's a whole lot going on there that we didn't really get to talk about just because of the nature of what we're trying to fit into about an hour.
Yeah.
But then we get into the Bronze Age, you know, the early 70s.
We start discussing the problems with drugs, the problems with civil rights movements, all of these things. And we really culminate that with the night Gwen Stacy died.
Right.
And by that point, there's no turning back. We are not in the Silver Age.
We are very clearly in a new age. Jack Kirby's leaving for DC, weaving his magic over there. It's just an
era of change.
Yeah.
And then we go all the way until about the mid 80s. And then we
Crisis
say...
Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Let's condense. We've got a 50th anniversary of DC.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, this is the point where we need to get our stuff together. And we are going to try to not convolute it. Which, paradoxically, opens up the world for events. And giant crossover events are why Marvel and DC are so convoluted today.
In large part, yes.
And then that leads us into other ages, and we'll talk about those other ages on other podcasts.
Sounds great to me.
So there it is. You've got Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age. You now know what they're talking about. And the next time somebody says, blah, blah, you don't know, you go, you know, that's a lot of information to have to just be able to pick out that one thing. But at least you have a couple of things that you know on your side, too.
Or alternatively, you can just say, hey, pack it in your shorts.
That's also something you can say. Dave Ziegler approves that. And you know what? Bryce does, too. So, you reading anything?
Well, let's see.
You reading anything classic right now?
Classic comics. Right now, I've been on a Bronze Age Wonder Woman kick for a while.
Okay.
For like the last year or so, I've been tracking down issues from this run that came out right around the time the Wonder Woman TV show was premiering with Linda Carter.
Oh.
That first season takes place during World War II. And so we kind of get focused on the Earth 2 Wonder Woman in the comics because that's still World War II. And so I was tracking down that storyline. I finally found the issues I was missing at WonderCon in the spring. And they are really fun books. I'm enjoying those. I've been picking up some older Batman and Detective, and I've been an ongoing project of mine is collect all the dollar comics from the various series.
Wow.
It's an ongoing project.
Yeah, that's a big project from what you were describing earlier.
Yeah, well, because sometimes they would have, well, I mentioned World's Finest and Superman Family, but they're also trying other anthologies. They did a, there was a 6-issue science fiction anthology called Time War. There was a 5 or 6-issue war anthology called All Out War that featured the Viking Commando.
Ooh.
Yeah. Pretty badass. Battle axe and an army helmet. Awesome. You know, stuff like that. Picked up a few Sergeant Rocks lately, Our Army at War, The Unknown Soldier. I've found that as I've gotten older, that my interest in other genres is kind of, I think I've alluded to that.
We talked about your search for some true romance.
Yes, yes, yes. And so I'm finding that it's okay for me to expand beyond the harbors of Marvel and DC superheroes. Mm-hmm. And see what else is out there.
Yeah.
And I want, that makes it sound like I'm just coming to this conclusion. I've been experimenting with other books for a while, seeing what else is out there. So.
Gotcha.
And I've got a ton of books. I think we've talked about how I always come home with this mountain of books from San Diego.
Right.
I'm still working my way
through that mountain.
Through that mountain. So there's a ton of classic books.
I've got a mountain probably about 2 feet high of comics that I was picking up. Because there was a point where I had like 15 things in my pull, and I got behind, and I felt guilty leaving them there, so I bought them all, obviously.
Yeah, well, you got to.
I'm not going to just put them onto their shelf, unless there was like an anthology, and they were like, hey, we got the entire arc, we'll just put them in a package together.
Dig it.
Which, once in a while, that happened.
And what about you, man? What are you reading these days? You got any classic books going?
Not really, actually.
Really?
I haven't done a lot of comic book reading in a while. Just because I've been in like 6 other genres and mediums for a bit. You got anything you'd recommend that is just a classic?
Yeah, actually, I do.
Okay.
You know, Marvel's putting out these Epic collections.
Okay.
Are you familiar with those?
No.
Okay, these Epic collections, what they went back and did, for example, for Spider-Man, they didn't lay them all out on the floor, but they went back through all their series of the Marvel Age and kind of mapped out where breaks would be.
Okay.
And so they're putting out, the ultimate goal is the entirety of all these series in these Epic collections.
Oh, man.
So, but you're not getting them like in the order that they were published. So, for example, Captain America, you don't get volume 1. The first one is like volume 12, but it's all... I think part of the reason they're doing it this way is to get some things into print that they haven't collected yet.
Ah.
Apparently, they've done all the math to get everything figured out which volume it would be in.
Yeah.
You know, but they've also done 2 volumes of Power Man and Iron Fist.
Oh, really? I do love me some Power Man and Iron Fist.
As do I. I mean, this is classic. Yellow shirt, steel.
Sweet Christmas,
steel tiara. Love me some Power Man and Iron Fist.
Well, all right.
Have you read The Immortal Iron Fist?
I've read some of The Immortal Iron Fist.
The entire thing is super good.
I think I have the most recent, like, The Immortal Iron Fist, the one where he's like, when that started.
No. By Kara Andrews?
Maybe. I don't know. When did it
It's hyper stylized art.
Was it Marvel Now?
Maybe.
2012-ish?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, I have the first trade of that. So, all right, where can I find you on the internet, Dave?
I'm on the tweeters, at Mr. Dave Ziegler.
And you can find our podcast at Sneaky Geek Pod on Twitter and at Sneaky Geek Podcast on Instagram. And that's that.
Guys, once again, I have to say thank you so much for listening. I would really encourage you to rate and review our podcast if you get the chance. Not only does it help us know how we're doing, but it can actually help us gain some notoriety down the line. Tune in next week for another exciting episode of Sneaky Geek. Until then, here is a recording I snapped of Dave humming the Superman theme while he was looking at merchandise and didn't know I was still recording. Sorry, Dave.